Welcome to the Fatigue Super Conference, and I am super excited for this conversation. I'm talking with Dr. Terry Wells, and she has an incredible story of how she has been on a journey with multiple sclerosis. And although this is a little different to ME, chronic fatigue, fibromyalgia, Lyme disease, adrenal fatigue, those kind of pieces that we're primarily focused on here, there is significant crossover. But also the protocol which Dr. Wells has developed has enormous relevance to the communities that we're looking to serve and support with this conference. So apart from her amazing story, I'm also incredibly excited to learn more about the approach. Just to give a bit more of a formal background, Dr. Terry Wells is a clinical professor of medicine at the University of Iowa. She is the author of The Wells Protocol, How I Beat Progressive MS Using Paleo Principles and Functional Medicine, and the cookbook, The Wells Protocol, Cooking for Life, the Revolutionary Modern Paleo Plan to Treat All Chronic Autoimmune Conditions. I also came across actually a third book, which wasn't listed in the bio, which I will send, which is Minding My Mitochondria, which was a recipe book. Dr. Wells also hosts the Wells Protocol Seminar every August, where anyone can learn how to implement the protocol with ease and success. And I'm sure we'll touch on that a little bit towards the end. So Dr. Wells, thank you so much for being with me. I really appreciate you making the time.
Hey, thank you so much. I love teaching the public about this.
I would love to start with a bit about your story, because you were working as a doctor in a traditional way with the usual kind of stresses and challenges that come with that. But in time, it became clear that something much more significant was going on with your own health. Tell us how that unfolded.
So, you know, I'm a professor of medicine here. I just taken a new job at the University of Iowa, where I was teaching residents and helping manage a primary care clinics for the VA. Now, during that time, I began to have problems stumbling and would ultimately get evaluated by a neurologist and MRIs of my brain, spinal cord, spinal tap, slew of blood tests, nerve conduction velocities. And my physicians noted that 13 years earlier, I'd had a problem with vision in my left eye. I now had weakness in my left leg and had abnormal spinal fluid and several lesions in my spinal cord. So I probably had optic neuritis 13 years earlier. They said I had relapsing remitting MS, relapsing remitting multiple sclerosis. And so I, you know, academic professor of medicine, I knew I wanted the best treatment from the best people. So I did my research. The Cleveland Clinic was doing clinical research in the Midwest. They were really the premier multiple sclerosis center. So I went there, figured out who their best physician was, saw her, started on the newest drugs. And over the next 3 years, I had one episode of weakness involving my right hand. And so had I been in a drug trial, that would have been counted as a huge success. But the problem was I was getting steadily weaker. I was beginning to have more trouble with fatigue. Now, my Cleveland Clinic physicians told me about the work of Loren Cordain. I read his papers, his books, read about lectins, and embraced the no grain, no legumes, no dairy, and made a huge change in my diet, because I'd been a vegetarian for 20 years. So I reintroduced meat, but I continued to decline. The next year, I needed a tilt recline wheelchair. I was advised that my disease was now secondary progressive MS. No spontaneous recoveries would be anticipated. Functions once lost would be anticipated to be gone forever. And so I took mitoxantrone, a form of chemotherapy. I continued to decline. I took Tysabri when it was first available. I very excited. I was thrilled to get to take it, but I continued to decline. And then I switched to CellCept. And that's when I'm like, you know, I have to do everything that I possibly can. I go back to reading the basic science and I begin experimenting. And I decide that mitochondria are the big driver of disability for MS. And so I devise, again, using animal studies, a supplement cocktail to support my mitochondria. And I figure out that that helps my fatigue a little bit, because I do better when I'm on my supplements, worse when I'm off. It may be slowing down the speed of my decline, but I'm still declining. I'm thrilled now that I'm learning stuff that my neurologist and my primary care doc don't know to tell me about. So I'm really fired up about reading. I am on the Institutional Review Board reviewing research for safety for the university. And I say, give me everything related to the brain and human studies. So I got more and more comfortable reading studies and beginning to experiment on myself. My supplement list was growing. By the summer of 07, my disease had progressed enough. The university and the VA had redesigned my job, so I was supervising residents and working on the Institutional Review Board. I had a zero-gravity chair in my office so I could recline back, my knees higher than my nose, had another one at home. I could walk very short distances, about 10 feet, using two walking sticks. I have trigeminal neuralgia that was getting more severe, more frequent visits to the pain clinic, higher and higher doses of gabapentin, and I was beginning to have brain fog. That summer, I think it was June, maybe early July, my chief of staff pulls me in and says, he's assigning me to the traumatic brain injury clinic come January, and there won't be any residents. I'll be seeing patients as part of a multidisciplinary team. And he described a job that physically I did not think I would be able to do. So that was upsetting. But you know, I tell my wife that, you know, at that point, either I can do the job or I'll have to take medical disability, at least apply for it if I can't. But God works in mysterious ways because just a couple weeks later, a research protocol that I'm reviewing talks about electrical stimulation of muscles for people with traumatic spinal cord injury. So I convinced my physical therapist to let me try that. And he fortunately used that as part of his athletic rehabilitation program. So I did that in clinic intensively for a couple weeks. Then I got me a home-going device. And I'm so weak, I can do like 5 minutes twice a day. That's where I'm starting from. And then at the same time, I discovered the Institute for Functional Medicine. They have a course on neuroprotection, which I take. I work my way through that. I have a longer list of supplements. Let's say a deeper understanding of what I could be doing. And not a lot's happening yet. But then I had this really big aha moment, like what if I redesign my paleo diet to maximize the intake of these nutrients in the food? So that's more research. I get that worked out. And December 26th, I start eating this new way. And then January, I go off to clinic. In the first week, I'm just watching. So I should be able to do that, just watch. The second week, I have to start examining these patients. At the end of the week, I'm like, you know, that was not too bad. And then the next week, I'm going to think, you know, my mental clarity is a little bit better. And my energy seems better. And my pain is less. And so I'm going to think, like, you know, maybe I can do this job. Now, the traumatic brain injury clinic, my partners were telling these guys and ladies, well, you had a terrible concussion. You're going to recover or not. We'll give you psych meds to deal with your rage and pain meds to deal with your pain. And you'll just either recover or not. Right. And so, you know, I'm doing the primary care for these folks, and I'm getting stronger. Then within 3 months, I'm beginning to walk using a cane. And people are stunned to see me walking around the VA. And then in 6 months, I'm walking without a cane. And I am beginning to talk to my traumatic brain injury vets like, no, there's a lot you can do. We can talk about your food, your meditation, your exercise. So I'm here to change my practice. I'm talking a little bit more about diet and lifestyle. But I want to remind everyone that when you have a progressive condition for which there's no cure, part of the adaptation process is you accept life. One day at a time, you don't know what anything means, what's going to happen. And so I've had remarkable recovery. I'm able to walk a little bit in the neighborhood. I can walk around my hospital, but I still don't know what that means. It was on Mother's Day in 2008 that, you know, I decide to ride my bike. We have a family powwow, and so I get on my bike, and I'm able to bike around the block. My kids are crying. My wife is crying. I'm crying. If you could see me up close, I'm crying now. Because that was the moment where I realized the conventional understanding of multiple sclerosis, progressive MS, is incomplete. That we don't understand how much recovery is possible when we address diet and lifestyle factors. So that's at 9 months into this new way of eating. At 12 months, I'm able to do an 18.5-mile bicycle tour with my family. And so at that point, how I practice in my primary care and how I practice in the traumatic brain injury clinic has radically shifted. I am now focused on diet and lifestyle. I'm not very interested in changing drugs, so I'm very interested in teaching people why diet and lifestyle matter. And I'm having remarkable success. In the traumatic brain injury clinic, you could tell who I saw that their pain was better, their fatigue was better, their vision was better, their ability to get along with their family and the coworkers was markedly improved. And of course, you know, this would ultimately change the focus of my research. Originally people thought I was sort of a nut job, a little too eccentric. But as time has gone on and my research has come forward, and I'd say the basic scientists and my scientific colleagues are paying attention to my research, I've gone from sort of banned to brilliant to visionary. I have more and more opportunities to collaborate with other researchers here at the university.
It's an incredible story. And I want to come back in a moment to how your clinical practice has evolved as a result of this. But I just want to touch on one other thing a bit more as well, which is really the attitude that you took to the circumstance that you found yourself in. Because a diagnosis of MS is a diagnosis which is fairly widely accepted to be something that, yes, one can do certain things to manage some of the symptoms and consequences. But I think part of the reason why it was so emotive for you beyond just your personal experience, when you realized that you were fundamentally kind of going against the grain of what should happen, was the realization of what this meant for a much wider population of people. But I'm curious, you know, for example, one of the things that you touched on and I have to say, it made me laugh out loud when I was reading your book, was that you were looking at research that had been done on mice, and you were extrapolating doses to apply them to yourself. And that's a certain kind of attitude of curiosity and kind of willingness to try things. But I wonder where that came from, like that, what you think helped support that attitude and that mindset.
You know, I have two young children. So when I was diagnosed, my son was 8, my daughter was 5. They're growing up. I'm getting more and more disabled. And so I decide I have to keep trying, doing everything that I can, get to work, because I need my kids to see that when life is difficult, you don't give up. And so I couldn't teach them perseverance and resolve, doing athletic and wilderness travel the way I'd planned. But I still could teach them perseverance and resolve by my daily choice of getting up, going to work, reading the research, doing my little workouts, even though they were steadily declining. They saw me every day doing my little workout, every evening doing my little workout. And they understood that I was reading the scientific literature. So I wanted them to know that I understood that my job was to do everything that I could to make me functional to support the family.
What you're describing is an act of love as opposed to an act of rage and frustration, which is, I think, what can often be the drive in that situation.
Well, you know, I certainly went through my period of anger and bargaining. Fortunately, I was able to not display any of that. But I'll tell you, certainly in my head, I went through that process. And I think many people do. Then I got to acceptance, like, okay, here's my reality. And as I was doing all of my reading and experimenting, I had completely accepted that recovery was not possible, that functions once lost were gone. I was doing all this in an attempt to slow down the decline. And I could tell that I was slowing the steepness of my decline because what limited function I had was, you know, incredibly useful to still be able to feed myself, to still be able to work cognitively, to still be able to take a few steps. Incredibly valuable. So if I could hang on to that for an extra year or two, doing all my reading looked very worthwhile.
I there's so many more questions I'd love to ask about this piece, but I'm mindful of time. So let's explore how that you touched on it a little bit earlier, but how this impacted upon your clinical practice. So there was obviously a journey that your colleagues went on in, as you said, but say a bit more about how you work now as a physician in a somewhat conventional medical environment but using this new protocol and this new way that you see things?
You know, so the first thing that transformed was in my primary care clinics, I spent a lot of time with the residents asking veterans what they were eating, their stress practices, how much movement they had, and we talk on toxin exposures. Then I'd relate how that impacts running the biology of life in their cells, and how the best way to improve their health was to address these diet and lifestyle factors. Now, mind you, I could only do this in about a 20-minute encounter, but I learned how to do that speaking at the same language and metaphors that my veterans would understand. So a lot of farm talk, a lot of basic farming concepts, but that's very effective because people understood that you can't get prize-winning animals or prize-winning corn feeding the corn, the soil, and the animals crap. You had to nourish them well. And I'm like, well, we got to take just as good a care of you as you would of your livestock or your soil. And that would resonate very quickly. Then we'd translate that into specific steps that they could take. And I was also mindful that, you know, depending on my clinic, I might have people who are living on food stamps. We had very difficult financial means. So we still were extraordinarily successful at getting people to go on this journey. But the first steps were helping them understand what they wanted their health for and connecting the environment to how the chemistry of life happens in their cells. And then showing them concrete steps they could take.
So before we come a bit more into some of the details of your protocol, maybe just say a bit about the kind of headline pieces. Like if you were to summarize the Wells protocol in a few kind of short statements, how would you do that?
So there are excluded foods. So things that are really inflammatory, we get out of your diet. Things that are really helpful, we ramp up the diet. So we remove gluten, dairy, and eggs, ramp up vegetables, particularly greens, cabbage family, onion family, mushroom family, in deeply colored beets, carrots, berries, kinds of stuff. And then I have different strategies for vegetarians and meat eaters, and I have a different strategy for those who need to be in ketosis. So there's sort of three big plans. And then on top of that, people who have not responded well or who have an autoimmune issue with joints, I have a more restrictive diet. It's a little more challenging diet for them, the Walls elimination diet that we guide them on. And I really help people begin where they're at and work incrementally towards making these changes. They really have to understand why to begin to go through the work of giving up foods to which their family and culture have valued for a long time and to which, frankly, they're probably addicted. So we have to be sure they understand why mechanically this change will make such a big difference.
Maybe that's a good piece to open up a bit more. And maybe one of the ways to do this is I want to explore a bit more about the role of microbiome in this. Maybe that's a helpful way to come into this more.
Well, you know, particularly our people who have livestock, they begin to understand that when the microbiome gets altered, the animals can go down very quickly. And you know, we go through explaining that. We're shocked to understand that how we run the chemistry of life, how we make all the molecules that we need for immune cells and our brain cells to work, we rely on the microbes in our gut to make some of those molecules, those steps, because we don't have the genes anymore. And so when some of those microbes are missing, we can't make all of the molecules that we need to make for our brain and our immune cells to work properly. And to have the best diversity in your microbes, you need maximal diversity in the food you eat. So we have to have lots of different kinds of food. I give them the challenge of 200 different plant species in a year. And if I can get people fried up about that, now they're much more interested in trying new foods because they're working on their list and trying new teas, new spices, because all those things count to the 200. You know, I explain that even I, who really believe this, I have to really work at it. You know, the first couple of years that my goal was 200 to really pay attention to these things.
So maybe also just to touch on a little bit around how the microbiome relates to autoimmune issues, for example,
sure.
Risk factor in MS. Yeah.
So it was early theorized that intestinal permeability or leakiness of the gut opens up the gates that lets bacterial fragments like lipopolysaccharides into the bloodstream. That ramps up our immune systems in general, the innate immunity, really ramps up the inflammatory molecules. It makes all the autoimmune processes running hotter, more on it, and harder to cool off. Another problem that can happen when these gates that are open, letting incompletely digested food proteins into the bloodstream, we get immune cell response to these proteins. And if these proteins are structurally similar to any proteins on our cells, when we attack those food proteins, we also attack our own internal structures. So gluten, for example, is similar to some structures in the brain, particularly in the cerebellum. And so we can begin to have some damage to our cerebellum. We can begin to have damage to brain proteins in general. And so you're more likely to develop mental health issues, psychoses, movement disorders, and multiple sclerosis, which of course, I'm very attuned to since that's what I suffer with. And the thinking is such that when you develop this leaky gut, it's one of the early steps that must occur to develop immune dysfunction, which if not reversed, will then go on to autoantibodies attacking organ tissues. Again, you'll have several years of that going on. And then if it's not addressed, then you have enough organ damage that now you get specific diagnoses. And again, if you don't address that, about every 10 years, you're going to get a new autoimmune problem. So, if I look back at my story, as a young person, I developed exercise-induced asthma. Then I developed severe menstrual pain, which I just thought, that was life. Later as an adult, we discovered I had severe endometriosis, and adenomyosis, and infertility. And by then, I'm also having neurologic symptoms. So now I have another autoimmune dysfunction. And now I also have some mild psoriasis as well. Now, all of these things went away and are beautifully controlled with a therapeutic diet and lifestyle. And none of them were well controlled using conventional pharmacologic-only therapies.
And is it your experience that if you correct and heal the leaky gut and balance the microbiome, that these kind of inflammatory kind of or autoimmune conditions start to self-correct? Or are there also pieces that you see necessary to help reduce inflammation and work on that more kind of locally?
It really depends on the individual. At the very root, you want to fix the gut, lower the inflammation, lower the leaky gut. That will cool things off. You might want to do some very targeted supplements to really ratchet down the inflammation in terms of gene expression level as well. And you certainly want to lower cortisol levels. So having a stress-reducing practice, very helpful. And then I also am quite increasingly committed that at the root of everything we do has to be the patient's meaning, understanding of their illness, their relationships, so they're willing to do the work that it takes to change behaviors, change diet. Because, we're asking people to develop new daily routines, to give up foods and patterns that had been successful in their lives, in their family, and socially. That is a phenomenally huge ask. And so we have to help them develop the belief, the interest, to understand what they want their health for, so they're willing to go on this journey. Otherwise, you're just like a conventional doc saying, do this, and I'll see you later. And that's tends to not be very effective.
How, given that you still own, am I right in thinking you still generally have 20-minute windows when you're working, or is that evolved?
So that's evolved. So I did all this 20-minute windows in primary care in my traumatic brain injury clinic. Then the VA said, oh my God, you have these stunning results. Let's get a clinic that you get to run the way you want. Okay. So that was pulled out of those clinics. We created the Therapeutic Lifestyle Clinic, and I got to design it the way I wanted. And as I was designing this, I had a huge demand. So we restructured this into group classes. So there's an introductory class for an hour that the veteran could come with themselves and a family member to hear the story in the context of functional medicine. Then they could say up too hard or work individually with a nutritionist who would help them, or come to the next step, which would, again, would be a series of group classes. A little smaller, would have 10 to 20 in that group. And one's a half-day class where we dive deep into functional medicine, the rationales, help them understand, and help the vet complete a number of forms themselves. So it's really educational and personalization of the protocol to them. Then they'd have a couple hours with the dietitian to help them understand how to implement the various diets that we discussed and help them reimagine their food. Then after that initial half-day class, then they come back once a month for group classes where we might explore life's meaning, the hero's journey, cooking classes, meditation, mindfulness classes, movement classes. And we'd also have another once a month support group where they just talk about their journey, their success, their challenges, and would get support from the group. And that might be up to about 10 people. So they'd have a chance to see us twice a month, once for skills and once for group support. We do that for the next 6 months. We have a few very basic primary care labs in there, but this is really a diet and lifestyle. And we had stunning success with a wide variety of issues, you know, many of which are the kinds of problems that your people have. Because the most common symptom was fatigue, pain, and brain fog, regardless of the underlying disease states. And the kind of diseases we would see would be fibromyalgia, chronic fatigue. We saw a lot of autoimmunity with a wide variety of autoimmune issues, of which pain and fatigue was the main disabling symptom, which is, you know, because we saw the sickest of the sick. Because we just said, you know, give us your most difficult patients, just let them know they're not going to get drugs from me. They'll just get diet and lifestyle. And so we, in fact, saw the sickest of the sick. And because we're having such success, you know, we got more and more, and we had a big waiting list. We got noticed nationally. They started expanding the staff. And, you know, then ultimately I handed all that off to my colleagues so I could spend more time doing, you know, exactly what we're doing today, Howard, which is, you know, talking to people around the globe and traveling around the globe, teaching these concepts.
I want to just back up something you were saying about the importance of kind of purpose and meaning. And I think it was, I might have this wrong because I was prepping a couple of interviews last night, but I think it was in your book that I read about the reference to Viktor Frankl's book, Man Search for Meaning. But as you were talking, that's confirmation that it was in your book. So as you were talking earlier, that telling your story, that was kind of in my mind. And what's so powerful about Viktor Frankl's book is obviously just people that don't know. Well, I'll let you tell the story, but just why that's important, what I'm curious, and how you help people find that.
You know, Viktor Frankl is a psychiatrist who was imprisoned in the death camps during World War II. And so he watched incredible acts of cruelty and incredible acts of love and faithfulness in the most terrible of circumstances. His main premise was that between every event in your life and your response to it, there's a space. And in that space, you make a choice. And that choice defines your characters. And you can choose a loving, supportive choice, or you can choose a hateful choice. And so as I was having to reimagine my life as a more and more disabled individual, I kept thinking about my kids and that what was most important to me was teaching them to be emotionally successful and financially successful adults. That meant they had to see me not give up, continue to be functional. And you know, I decided the message I could convey to my kids is, yep, life's difficult, it's not fair, and so what? Just do the best you can anyway. And you know, and both my kids at various times you know, would get really mad that they had all these chores and responsibilities in our family life that none of their friends had. And I'd go, yeah, yeah, that is so unfair. I can see why you're angry and upset. But this is your job. You know, it's really unfair that I have MS. I can't do it. But I just have to go do work as best I can. And life's not fair.
I think that's beautiful how you turned the circumstance into a lesson rather than something to be a victim and be frustrated about.
You know, and we actually talk a lot of, in our meetings classes, like there is a gift in your circumstance. You may have to struggle a lot to find that gift. And we talk about our cancer patients that we've taken care of who know they're dying from their illness and still find a tremendous gift because it lets them define their closing days, heal relationships, set priorities, and say the things that they wanted to be sure got said to the people that mattered to them. And so they were still grateful even for their cancer that was going to kill them because it gave them focus and direction for their closing days. What I found, so all of all the classes that we taught, it was these meaning classes that were the most popular, the most profound for my vets. And so I began to move those classes earlier and earlier and earlier in my curriculum because I saw how powerful they were. And now actually I talk about this in my introductory lecture. We explore it deeper in some of our classes, but we talk about purpose, meaning, and Viktor Frankl's very important premise that we have a choice in how we respond to the events in our life.
And I imagine people are willing to hear that from you in a way that they might not be willing to hear from some others because they realize that it's a lived, breathed, felt experience as opposed to just an idea.
Yes, yes. You know, in our vets really loved when we would talk about our realities. So everybody in my clinic, all the staff, we talked about the difficult realities of our life that we had to deal with. And the truth is, Alex, we all have difficult things. And we're taught in our trainings to never talk about your personal life. But our patients understand that life is messy and difficult and hard. And unless you are abhorred into incredible wealth and privilege, most of us have had to deal with disappointments, frustrations. When we talk honestly about that, it creates a profound connection with our patients and our clients.
I'd love to maybe broaden this piece around dealing with psychology and emotions to also explore pain, because I think pain is something that there's an inflammatory piece to. There's often also psycho-emotional elements to that. So I'd be curious as to, particularly for those that are watching or listening to this, that are suffering from fibromyalgia, for example, where there's a strong pain element to their experience.
Yeah.
What are some of the key pieces that you look at when you're working with the pain elements?
So I tell people that I have trigeminal neuralgia. So that's when the neuropathic pain gets turned on. And then I have these electrical jolts of pain across my face. And they get triggered once that episode's been turned on by increased inflammation because I got exposed to toxins or gluten. The reactivity turns on and light, sound, a breeze on my face, swallowing, talking, trigger this electrical pain that's really quite horrible. And so I finally understood that if I can turn the inflammation down, the pain does not happen. I might need steroids at the time that I got triggered so I can get things quiet. But as fearful as I was of my pain and the years of intense suffering that I had, I now see that trigeminal neuralgia as this tremendous gift because it gives me a barometer of how clean is my environment, how inflamed is my brain. If I'm beginning to have a little bit of that early twinge, I know that I have to stop, look back very carefully, what was the trigger to the inflammation, and address that. And so we talk to our folks with pain and let them know that this is their barometer to how clean their environment is, how much inflammation there is, how much oxidative stress there is. And we can't change our genes. We can change gene expression by our diet and lifestyle. we can often reduce the NF-kappa-B and some of the other signaling molecules that drive inflammation. And we do that with attention to diet and lifestyle factors, toxic exposures. And so we spend a lot of time talking about recognizing that pain is your body's cry for attention and help. The more deeply we listen and the more deeply we address all those environmental factors to turn off inflammation, turn off oxidative stress. Again, for most of our patients with a wide, wide variety of disease states, they would come back and say, this is my pain's beginning to abate. My pain is diminishing. My pain is manageable. My pain is controlled. Now I can see what are the triggers that ramp up the pain. It is a process, but you know, very typically by the end of this journey, the end of the 6 months of working with me, my patients now have a very different relationship to pain. They see pain as a friend. It's a barometer to help them understand how well the biology, the chemistry is happening in their cells. And they've learned how to create a steadily more healthful cellular environment.
What you're describing is also, I think, a great example of working in a multifaceted way, in a sense of trying to deal with the kind of the root causes, but also that being an appropriate place to bring down inflammation if it's acute, using steroids, whatever that may be, but also looking at the other sources of inflammation. It really is a great way of highlighting the way that you're working in lots of different levels. And I suppose it opens up a curiosity in me around when you're working with people. Am I correct in my understanding that it sounds like what you're doing is that there's a kind of starting point of addressing the fundamentals that everyone needs to have in place, and that's the kind of group work that you're doing. Then there's a gradual focusing towards the kind of the more personal specifics. Is that right?
Yeah, you know, what's really interesting, so when people are in their support groups, so there's the intake and then the classes for skill building, then there's support groups. And in a support group, people come in and leave, and so there's a staggered mix in that group. Some people who are new to the support group, and then you'll have folks who've been there several months. And so there's a lot of peer-to-peer interaction with the more seasoned support folks telling the new folks that, yes, your pain will get better if you do these things. Your pain will diminish, your energy will improve if you begin to adopt this stuff. And the peers can often help them understand how you can have treats for your grandchildren without sugar, how to talk to an in-law about your dietary needs, or strategies to deal with these kind of social environments. And what I see is this peer-to-peer group discussion is vastly more effective than my telling them what to do or you telling them what to do. But when they hear from a peer colleague say, oh yeah, I did that, I suffered that way, and here's how I handled it. And this is a way that I think you could try talking about it. That gets heard in a way that a conversation from you and I will not get heard.
It's interesting. We started doing group kind of workshops, as it were, about 12, 13 years ago. And actually, originally, we started doing it because it seemed to be a more cost-effective way for people to be able to access the work we were doing. And it was that was the primary thing for the benefit of the patients. We then quite quickly discovered exactly what you're saying, which was that people would be able to hear things from peers that they wouldn't be able to hear from us, or things would land more deeply or with kind of more practical implementation steps. And that it's interesting that what you're describing, that I think sometimes people coming into groups can be quite reluctant because they can feel shame around their condition, or they can be used to being disbelieved or misunderstood by people around them. What do you notice helps people open up?
When we began to have different levels of expertise in the peer, so you'd have in a mixed group, you'd have people who had been coming to group for five sessions, and someone who is just starting. So you have experts of experience with the group within the group, And over time, these newbies begin to see the modeling of the more senior peer mentor, and they grow into becoming a senior peer mentor to the next newbie that follows them. It's sort of like the family camp that we used to go to, church camp, that I watched my young children being mentored by these older kids in a very loving way. And then over the 10 years we went to camp, I saw my children become the peers in being very loving and nurturing to the younger children. I think that's something that humans like to do. It brings out the best in all of us. And repeatedly, we would see that happening, that people could transform their own health journey into a positive mentoring experience for the newbies that followed them.
I know one of the things also that, and you touched on it a little bit earlier, that you pay a lot of attention to, is that people can often feel put off by a functional medicine approach because of the cost and the fact that they're having to change what they're eating and change their lifestyle. And I know that you have a very passionate position that that money shouldn't be an obstacle, and actually there are ways to make these changes which are accessible.
Oh, absolutely. So my clinic of practice for 17 years was at the Veteran Affairs Hospital. So many of the people that we saw are living on fixed incomes, living on government support or food stamps. And so financial means are extraordinarily difficult. And so we worked with their reality. We gave them a lot of cooking classes, teaching them that if you cook with ingredients, it's much less costly than if you buy processed food or even fast food. And so we had to teach them cooking. And of course, we would use some vegetarian meals with high pressure cooking to make this more affordable. And we'd talk about growing their own food, foraging. My folks love to go foraging for wild food, so that was a very popular class. And here in the Midwest, most folks have access to friends who are hunters. And so wild game, terrific nutrition, also it tends to be very accessible. And my vets taught me that once they really got this, they're going to farmers markets and going up to the vendors and figuring out who's has little or no pesticide use, and would go up to these vendors and say, okay, now at the end of the market, what's the best price you would give me for everything that's left? And so they were able to find ways of getting access to food very inexpensively. So it was not uncommon for people, again, there'd be a lot of older peers to newbies teaching them these concepts. So it was very common for people to come in getting frozen food, canned food, you know, struggling, learning how to cook. And then by the time they're done, they've figured out how to go mostly organic while living on food stamps. And of course, this means cooking, scrambling, being a bit innovative, and also prioritizing that the quality of the food matters. But, you know, in my introductory classes, I reassure people that we'll work with you with the foods that you can buy in your small town grocer in the middle of rural Iowa, rural Wisconsin, Illinois, and then show you how to improve the quality of your food within your financial reality.
I guess you're also staying quite seasonal then in terms of the actual foods that are around, right?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
So I'm mindful of time, but I just love to touch on a little bit the research that you're doing. I know that it's something which has been a key piece from your perspective, and I was mentioning before we started recording, from our point of view as well, it's a challenging but crucial process. But just tell us where you're at with that.
So I've done a number of pilot studies using diet and lifestyle with progressive MS, great results. And then with relapse-remitting MS, again, very nice results. We have some amazing videos of the before and after showing these remarkable changes in walking ability. And then we've done studies with ketogenic diets. Those results are being written up. Exciting results. And then we now have a study funded by the National Multiple Sclerosis Society. Wow. With relapse-remitting MS, we're monitoring fatigue, quality of life, motor function, vision function, changes in the microbiome, changes in nutritional profile. And I'll be analyzing that data next year and submitting it to research meetings. So it'll probably be getting out to the public, I would say, in the fall of 2020. So about a year from now, we'll be submitting all this stuff. It'll be incredibly exciting. And of course, we're writing more grants. The next proposal that we're looking for funding from philanthropists, because we've raised a lot of money. We're very close to being able to launch this study, which in the new would be comparing newly diagnosed multiple sclerosis patients who would be using therapeutic diet and lifestyle only. So they've declined drugs, they're just doing lifestyle. And we'll compare them to a cohort of folks that are just doing a standard drug-based therapy with or without diet and lifestyle. And the question is a therapeutic lifestyle without drugs, what happens? And is that harmful, or can people get control of the disease just as well as using drug-based therapy? And that, to get that study going, is a philanthropy-based study. So we're very close. We have to raise $500,000, and we are well past halfway point. So I'm very optimistic that we'll be launching that study probably in October or November this year.
That's incredibly fascinating, and that's very, very cool. And just from one person to another, I know how challenging I imagine some of the ethics of that's been quite challenging as well in terms of getting.
Getting approval, getting funding, this is all challenging. You know, the other thing that we've done that I'm really excited about is we have done this deep dive nutritional analysis of the Swank diet, of the Walls diet, and we've published it in a high impact nutrition journal. So when people are saying, okay, the Walls diet, you know, this is not nutritionally sound, we actually now have a scientific peer review, high impact journal publication that has looked at that and said, well, you know what, it is nutritionally sound. And I think this is vital when we're doing these therapeutic diets, that someone take the time to do the nutrition-based research that analyzes the nutrients and sorts out, are the nutritional deficiencies that we have to think about? Do we have to restructure the food rules to be sure that there are no deficiencies? And that's the work that my research lab does. We do the intervention studies and we do the deep dive nutritional analysis studies.
Dr. Wells, I wish we had more time, but I'm mindful of time. You spoke earlier about how your role has transitioned from less of the focus on the day-to-day clinical and more around the awareness and the research. So for people that want to find out more about you and your work, talk a bit about what they can find on your website, but also I know you have your summer retreat that you want run. So yeah, tell us about that.
So if you just want to get our research papers, you can go to drtrailwalls.com/research papers. And you can download copies of our papers and you can get access to those videos that show the before and after gait change. Dramatic stuff. If you want a one-page summary of our diet, you go to terrywalls.com/diet. Great one-page summary to get started. If you want to learn either as a patient or as a practitioner, come to our seminar. We've got information about that at terrywalls.com. You get 3 days of intensive lectures. It's a lot of skill-based practices. We have a beginner's track, an advanced track. And then for the health professionals, we have another day of additional case-based learning and interaction with other professional colleagues. Then you have a chance, if you want, to take an exam that will qualify you as a Walls Protocol Certified Health Professional. If you've got a health profession license or certificate, then you're eligible for that exam. We have virtual trainings for the health professionals as well. So that's really expanded. And we have many more folks in Europe and Africa and Asia who are taking advantage of the virtual program.
Amazing. I have to say, it's an incredibly inspiring story, but I love the fact that it's so practical in terms of the execution and the strategy beyond just your personal experience of what this actually means for the people you're supporting. So Dr. Wells, thank you so much for your time. I really do appreciate it.
Thank you so much.